morning, everyone, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Before I introduce this morning's speaker, I want to thank everyone for being flexible and patient with us as we transition TMR to this virtual platform. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, John Zogby. John Zogby has spent the past four decades as one of the most accurate pollsters in the world, conducting business in 80 countries and leading the way in finding the meaning, story, direction, and usefulness of the data collected. His client list is a who's who of Fortune 500 companies, including GE, Microsoft, Cisco Systems, Coca-Cola, and IBM, global NGOs, including UNAIDS and the World Health Organization, and government agencies, including the U.S. State Department, U.S. Department of Defense, the mayors of New York City, Houston, and Miami. His unique data-driven analysis has led to board and commission memberships for think tanks, the congressionally appointed Advisory Commission of Public Diplomacy, global non-governmental organization like Sudan Sunrise, which he chaired for 4 years, and the AMAR Foundation, Economic Development and Entrepreneurial Promotion, and healthcare, among others. He has found time to mentor hundreds of students over the years of his spare time. A master storyteller, he is a sought-after speaker with over 125 speeches per year across the globe since 1999, as well as the author of three path-breaking books: The Way Will Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream; First Globals, Understanding, Managing, and Unleashing the Power of the America's Millennial Generation; and We Are Many, We Are One, Neo-Tribes and Tribal Analytics in the 21st Century America. He honed his skills as a teacher and storyteller, teaching history at local colleges for 3 decades. John's regular columns for Forbes.com and the Washington Examiner dissect the intersection between cultural values and political behavior. A former senior advisor at the Belfer Center at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, John is the first senior fellow at the Institute of Policy Research and Catholic Studies at the Catholic University of America. He spent 2 years as the founding director of the Keenan Center for Entrepreneurship at his alma mater, Le Moyne College. He has received 3 honorary doctorates and 1 Chancellor's Award for Excellence. His 3 sons have followed in his footsteps. He lives with his wife, Kathy, a former special education teacher and children's book author in upstate New York. Please join me in welcoming John Zogby.
Hi, wow, thank you. What a nice intro, and thanks for inviting me back. I did this years ago. Most importantly, hello, Gail Cowley. I know you're out there. Good to see your name up here.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. I don't see you yet, but I will. let's just get right into it. Okay. I've seen my profession of opinion polling go from highly respected to one where we scare little children on the streets. And I have a few things to say about my industry that I hope will clarify any misconceptions and underscore any genuine concerns that you have. So let's take a little trip with me back to when I started, September of 1984. And at that point in time, picture a world where there is such a thing called an answering machine, but not very many people have one, where the landline penetration in the United States alone is 96%, which means it's universal. And where there are no filtering technologies beyond, even beyond the answering machine. And so technologically and culturally and socially, when the telephone rings in your home, it's an event and you're trained to answer it, even if it's not at a convenient time. Otherwise, it's rude to answer it. So imagine, if you will, that response rates are 65%. For every person who's reached on the telephone when we dial, 2 out of 3 will take, for every 3 people, 2 will take the survey. One of them gladly take the survey and not mind if it's 40, 50, 60, 80 questions. Invariably, we would hear, shh, I have a long distance call. Somebody's calling me from someplace in New York. It's important. They're asking me questions. On the flip side, this is 1984, and it's going to be hard to believe. We would reach a woman of a certain age at home, maybe late afternoon or early evening, and she would say, oh, you're asking me questions about things I don't know. You have to wait until my husband comes home. That was the demure housewife who barely exists today. But also think about the side story there. She's telling a total stranger from who knows where, I'm home all by myself. This is a world that we have forgotten about, or we think that it's a world that's 100 years old, but it's not that long ago. And it goes back to when I first began. But within a short period of time, tremendous changes are taking place. And so by the mid and the late 1980s, the answering machine or the answering service becomes almost pervasive. More and more women enter the workforce, so there's nobody home. Thirdly, the dinner hour or the dinner whatever is sacred. So is helping kids with homework. So are the numbers of people who are not home in the evening and are working a day shift or an overnight shift. And so too are the pervasive telephone calls. If those of you are old enough to remember back MCI versus Sprint versus AT&T versus no fee checking account to the myriad, just a myriad of bothersome, annoying phone calls. And this is what's going on with the polling industry. And so we see by the 80s into the 90s, response rates are plummeting. By the 1996 election, even at a point of high interest in the election, we're able to scratch out a 26% response rate. That's quite a dip. But even especially under normal times when there isn't an election and we're just polling for retail or polling hypothetically for a political race, we see response rates go down in the teens. For that matter, by the mid-90s, in major metropolitan areas like New York and LA, we have single-digit response rates. So something has happened and will continue to happen. And in addition to the technology, people are enabled to not answer the telephone because more than likely, it's not friends and family who are calling. More than likely, it is a nuisance. And more than likely, polls calling are tipping on the nuisance side. So we began, as early as 1997, I wrote a piece in a journal that no longer exists called Public Opinion. And I said, we've got to take a look at this internet. It's growing penetration. It's not there yet, but at some point in time, just as many people are going to have internet access at home as have telephone access at home. And for that, there were a lot of folks in my industry who were not ready to understand that we can plow through with low response rates. We just have to make more telephone calls. It may take longer, could be much more expensive. There was a hesitance to adjust. And then the cell phone comes along. And the cell phone really makes our job very, very difficult for a bunch of reasons. Not the least of which, those of you who have children, say, under 35, know that young people are instinctively trained to not answer their cell phone. Whether it's you, their parent, calling, or it's a phone number that they don't recognize or one that they've blocked, the cell phone is not research-friendly tool. And so we're seeing, as we waltz through the 2000s, that landline penetration in the United States is plummeting. And so by the time we get to like 2015, landline penetration in the US is where landline penetration was in the US in the 1950s, meaning it's about 61%. Cell phone penetration is up, but people are trained to screen out cell phone calls. But those who stick to the telephone survey model are finding that whereas in the early part of this century, maybe a third of our sample should be drawn from cell phones, we see then with each election cycle, it's a half but should be cell phones. We're up to about 70% that have to be cell phones. Now, let me explain to you the technology problem alone with that. If our response rates calling landlines is now in single digits, and that's where it is, may get up to 12% high interest in this election, then response rates to a cell phone are infinitesimally small. 1%, less than 1%, 100,000 dials to reach one person. And then it's worse than random. Who's that one person out of 100,000 who's answering the survey? Maybe it's an African-American, but an African-American from Nebraska who is not representative of African-Americans, you know, in major cities. It's much more difficult to draw the sample, much more difficult to get the response rates that we need. And then the further problem is that in order for pollsters who still use the telephone model to find out what's truly going on a cell phone, you cannot ask more than 18 or 20 questions, figuring half of those are just simple basic demographic questions, and the other half of which are very basic. Do you intend to vote? Who would you vote for? Are you favorable or unfavorable to these people? Now some statistics, thank you very much. And that's not my industry. My industry is to do much more than ask who are you going to vote for, and then do demographic breakdowns of which demographics support which candidates. It's to probe values. It's to ask 30 or 40, 60, 80 telephone questions. And those days are virtually gone, unless you're paying an incentive for people to stay on the phone. But your response rates are still troublesome. And so at Zogby, we were aggressive in developing online polling methodology, knowing that it was the wave of the future, and with each passing year, that the future was now. And so we started coming out publicly, and I'll admit early, maybe a little too early, with online political polls, which bothered sort of the establishment figures and the trade association among pollsters very much. They were going to stick to the old technology. But the more we developed it and the more we expanded the base of our pool of people that we could contact for polling, the more accurate the polling became. And I think more importantly, the better the distribution. And that's our first learning term for the day. Better distribution, meaning we got a better representation of harder to reach groups in our sample. Young people, non-whites, poor people. And so we could draw conclusions and we could ask a lot more questions. We can allow people to take the poll within a certain time frame, but at their convenience. And we found that by 2008, the internet poll was working for us. So now what's happened? Here's what I think has happened to the polling industry. This was a very bad year, particularly for university polling and for the network polling, a heavy reliance on an outmoded technology and a motto that I really eschew, which is their governing principle, which is we're going to continue to do business the way we've always done it, which really no industry can say, or at least say with a straight face anymore, let alone the polling industry. So here's what happened. Heavy reliance on the telephone, poor sampling as a result. There's an insularity among pollsters, especially those who are holed in New York and in Washington and on university campuses, meaning an insularity, there is a tendency to oversample Democrats. This is not anything new. I've been writing about this now for 24 years, and I am myself a progressive Democrat. So it's not an ideological thing with me. It's an industry problem. And so because of that, I think that a lot of mainstream polls have done a great disservice in the way that they've been reported and the way that they've been handled. So, for example, I'll do a poll and I'll have, this happens to be the case, a 2-point lead for Joe Biden over Donald Trump. That was early October. Everybody else, at least among mainstream pollsters, is 10, 12, 14, 16 points lead for Biden. Now look at the internals of that poll. What I'll see is a tremendous disparity, differential between the number of Democrats in that sample and the number of Republicans in that sample. So I know from exit polling and from closely watching trends, and I'll explain the eye that we use and that others, to be fair, use as well to determine how many Democrats and how many Republicans there should be. But I do know that the differential between Democrats and Republicans among the electorate is maybe about 4 or 5 percentage points at most, meaning maybe about 38-39% Democrats in among the electorate, 34-35% Republicans. So if some of these polls are polling 44-45% Democrats in their sample, 28-29% Republicans, you're going to get a skewed result, pure and simple, a skewed result, meaning, you know, we know 95% of Republicans, we all showed them, support Donald Trump, and 93-94% of Democrats support Joe Biden. Well, pure and simple arithmetic, if you have too many Democrats and too few Republicans, you're going to get a double-digit lead for Joe Biden, which we just simply never saw. And in that sense, it was misleading and harder and harder to break through to punditry and to the TV networks and to the New York Times and the Washington Post, who would stick with their own polls. And I don't really mean to cast aspersions, but look, let's face it. Donald Trump hated these folks. They hated right back. The major news media in this country should be adversarial, but they became oppositional. And they, two sides, symbiotically, fed off of each other. The more the networks hated Trump, the bigger their numbers. The more Trump used the networks as foil, the bigger his numbers. And bottom line is, You just had a confluence of too many things that took place. So what's wrong with the industry? Too heavy reliance on the telephone. I think we've come to the point where while some polls still have to be conducted by telephone, for the most part, the industry has to shift to online technology. 94% of likely voters in the United States have internet access, either at home or on their mobile phone. Number two, my industry needs to pay much closer attention to political party identification. For me, it's a demographic. It's like it as important as your age, your religion, the region you come from, whether you live in a large city or rural, your political party identification, even if you simply inherited it from your parents and don't even necessarily feel that you're a Democrat or Republican, as long as you identify as a Democrat or Republican, your behavior and your worldview is much more likely to tilt that way than even you think it should. Or it does. And so bottom line is, many of my colleagues refer to to party identification as a trailer variable, meaning it's not an important thing. Party is ephemeral. Party is here today, gone tomorrow. I treat it, and I'm not the only one, of course, but I treat it as a lead variable. That in other words, I said I'm a progressive Democrat, but sometimes there are things that I'll disagree, you know, with Bernie or AOC about, but I still filter my information as a progressive Democrat. And that means that it's an important thing for me and how I see issues. And I think that the pollsters need to pay closer attention. If they see a sample coming in with 44% Democrat and 28% Republican, that is just not the United States of America. And believe me, I don't mean this to sound as an anti-elite or anti-intellectual statement in any way, but you take any city in the United States, big, medium, or small, and drive 10 miles outside that city, and you are bombarded with Trump Pence signs, lock her up still, poor Hillary. There are Republicans out there. Republicans, you know, honestly, in typical university or in a typical polling office at ABC News, Republicans are a sighting, or they are people out there that we don't deal with. Or in the famous words of Barack Obama, oh, they've got their guns and their religion. Let's talk about something else. And so in that sense, I think the combination of the technology and the insularity has hurt this field. Thirdly, you didn't even know what one and two are. Well, technology and party identification. Number three, I think what's missing from a lot of polling is the human element. Too much of a tendency to slam, bam, thank you, bam. Who are you going to vote for? How strong are you? Are you favorable or unfavorable? A few more questions and then the demographics. I want to know what pushes people's buttons. I want to know what the drivers are. I want to know, not if you're pro-choice or pro-life, but is terminating a pregnancy manslaughter? Let's cut right to the heart. I want to know, in case of a woman's right to choose or pro-life, I want to give four or five options because I want to get down with granularity where you stand and also how important it is to you. I want to know more about voters. Let's stick with that abortion question. Instead of it being two-dimensional, pro-life, pro-choice, I want to know, and I have found out, in the same poll many times. 57% say terminating a pregnancy is manslaughter. And 57% say that a woman has a right to choose. There's an overlap there. And that means that we are not one-dimensional people, one-dimensional voters. We're conflicted. So now, which of those sensibilities, the manslaughter or the pro-choice, is the dominant one at this moment? And which one, if either, are going to drive your vote? It's the sort of same thing about guns. It's the same thing about how do you view God, the watchmaker or the omniscient, all-present God that governs our lives. I think what's missing from polling is that human element, that desire to draw out what are the core values, not only in this individual, but in the 1,000 or 1,500 or however many that we poll. That illuminates what voting decisions are. That illuminates why I'm going to press one button over another. I think that the industry needs to welcome innovation, that it's not a one-size-fits-all. I've had my battles over the years with APOR, the American Association for Public Opinion Research, which I think is dominated by academic pollsters that really poll for a television network and not clients. I know that when I poll for clients, I have to, honestly, I have to give good science, but I also have to produce a product for them that's affordable and that tells them something about who their customers are, who their employees are. And I think that, we need to do more and more innovation in the field. And finally, and I know you'll have a lot of questions, I think that we as an industry and the media as an industry have to be much more realistic about what you get from a poll, what you can't get from a poll. We need reasonable expectations. So I've had a very good career. I've gotten a lot of elections right. I've gotten a lot of elections right that nobody else did. To be honest with you, in this election cycle, I had Biden leading by 5.6 percentage points. It looks like he's won thus far with 3.9 percentage points. I don't think anybody would shoot me for being 1.7 off. A good, pretty good performance there. Second closest among the polls that are out there. But polls are much more important than forecasting the next day. They should be telling us who's likely to win, why, who's likely to lose, and why. What are circumstances under which the person behind could win? What are the drivers and the major factors that got people to vote the way they did? It's not a forecast model. We're not producing polls for Jimmy the Greek and telling people, here's where to bet your money. We're not polling data. We're polling people. There are some people that can change their mind. Even this year, 4% told us, I made up my mind in the polling booth. Sometimes it's 10 to 14%. Who tell us that they made up their minds in the polling booth. If we're stopping polling the Sunday or Monday at noon before the election, there are still some people out there that could change their minds. In this election cycle, it was different. It was important for us to know that going into election day, there were only 3% who were undecided, actually closer to 2%. Normally, it's 7 to 10 who are undecided going into the election day. And then on top of that, there's usually another 10% or so who support either of the two candidates, but say I can still change my mind. This time around, it was 95% of Republicans were for Trump, 93, 94 Democrats were for Biden, zero chance of changing their minds. So you had very little wiggle room. Those are the sorts of things that we needed to communicate. And I believe that the industry did very, very poorly, allowed itself to get trapped into the forecasting model, allowed, as the media did in particular, the aggregators at the New York Times or at 538 to come up again with these very foolish numbers. You know, Joe Biden has a 91% chance of winning. Joe Biden did not have a 91% chance of winning. It was likely and very likely, but there was still a narrow path to victory for Donald Trump. And we saw that. There was indeed a narrow path. And I'm a little tired of this one-dimensionality of polling and how polling is interpreted. And I have a lot more to say, but I'm going to leave it at that for the time being, because I think, you know, that's about 30 minutes or 31 minutes or so. And so let's see. So thanks. And then Emily, how do you want to handle these?
So I will just get us kicked off. The first question, why do we need political parties? Can't they just go away?
Political parties or political polls?
Political parties.
Oh, okay. Woo, thank God. I'd rather the parties go than the polls. That's a very good question. And, you know, James Madison warned about it. So did George Washington. Factionalization. It was a problem back then of political leaders and people breaking up into special interests and not having the national interest or the interests of the national community in mind. It was more special, regional, commercial, civil rights kinds of interests in mind. Fact of the matter is, I think that there is a tendency, because we have competing worldviews, there is a tendency to bunch up into political parties. We always have. We go back to the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, and they've always been with us. At times, they've realigned, but I suspect we're coming at the end of a certain realignment now. And I also suspect, knowing what I do about millennials and Gen Z, that political parties do not serve their needs and interests. Today's people under 35, for example, are not hierarchical at all. And so they don't relate to, you know, the pyramid structure of a political party. They're much more horizontal. So I think that is one piece that will cause the demise of political parties. And I think secondly, even though among young people, more of a tendency to define themselves as liberal than older age groups, I think we have to dig down a little deeper in terms of what they mean by liberal. What we do know is that they are less and less conservative. And I suspect as we move forward and their world, the world of younger people as they move into their 40s and so, we're going to have a realignment more along the lines of not liberal conservative, which is where we are now pretty much, but a libertarian communitarian. And I think those are two softer kinds of ideologies, more flexible ideologies, and two ideologies where in fact there is reasonable intersection. So I'm hoping that what we see is less hard factionalism and more cooperation.
Thank you. Next question. Is there a way polling could be done through the CPS or other census surveys?
Well, it is. It is indeed already. The only problem is if you're referring to election polling, there's a time sensitivity to it. You know, the census and the American Community Survey are long and ungainly, and they take a long time. They're comprehensive. There are holes. You know, they're not perfect, but they're broad and comprehensive, and they take in hundreds of thousands, millions of respondents. And it's not the sort of thing where you can get a tally and get that snapshot of a moment in time. And especially a world where the news travels as quickly as it does, and that can change what people are thinking, change how they react. I would say that probably not. So we stick then to, you know, our smaller random samplings.
Thank you. Next question, what kind of response rates do you get from internet polling, and how do you measure that?
They average about 15%. And how do we measure it? So just broadly speaking, we operate from a pool of about 15 million email addresses that are already filled with data points. So each email address is a real person with demographics and behavioral information attached to it. These are constantly being validated and updated. In fact, even by randomly by telephone, we'll do that. And then they're already representative of the adult population of the United States. So if we're doing a poll, let's say of 1,000 voters nationwide, what we'll do is we'll take those 15 million and we'll draw a random probability stratified sample. Instead of taking just 10,000 email addresses, what we'll do is we'll block them. We'll take about 30% of what we need from the Northeast and about 30% from the South, you know, representative of that regional block as it is to the whole. And then we'll take about 10,000 and send out a simultaneous invitation to all 10,000, inviting them to a secure website where they take the poll. The poll cannot be transferred. I can't forward it to all my friends in the fraternity at University of Michigan and say, take this poll, or friends and family. It can't be gamed, in other words. And it's a one-time use, and then it shuts down. But then from, as the data is then collected on that secure website, then we do our tallies and our cross-tabulations. I hope that answers broadly what the question is.
Thank you. How do you account for people not answering honestly on polls?
I get this all the time. Liars vote, I guess. So why shouldn't there be liars in the sample? But it's one thing to lie. It's another thing to think of it in terms of a conspiracy that could change the results of your poll. So let's say we're polling 1,000 people. Who's lying, and who's lying in what direction? And do they cancel each other out? And could there be more than 10 or 15 people lying? Is there enough to make it a conspiracy? If 40% are lying, what direction? You know, that's just too wild to believe. So we'll just stick with the accuracy of the polls. Just stick with them. By and large, they work. This year, I don't think it was lying. I think it was just rotten sampling.
Next question. Is Nate Silver reliable? From 538.
I, in the past, have found myself engaged in a personality conflict with Nate Silver. My answer to you is, it's interesting what he does, but be skeptical, because his business is gathering data and polling polls. Our business is talking to people and collecting motivational factors from those people and getting at the why people do what they do. I don't think in any kind of social science situation, just as I felt when I was teaching history, that everything could be put into a bottle and shaken up, and from there you get a portrait of a community or a portrait of a nation. There are stories, there are human emotions, there are reactions. And I don't think that aggregating industry, he and the young fellow at the New York Times capture that. And so by and large, I'm going to have to say not reliable, because there have been two elections now in a row where we've awakened to both the New York Times and the 538 telling us that the Democrat has a 91% chance of winning. And then as the votes come in, it's like the ticker of the national debt on Times Square, 91, 90, 87, 52, 40. Well, what good is that? I think we need to get out of the forecasting business and get into the why people did what they did. Long answer to a short question.
I'm going to quote this person. They said, "I think pollsters have known about problems with demographic penetration and party skewing for a long time, 15 to 20 years. Why hasn't the industry figured out a solution?"
Well, you're with me because I've known about it for 26. Well, there's an old saying, if we, want to get into paleontology, if you kick a mastodon in the ass, 20 minutes later, it'll say, ouch. I think that they just haven't been able to come to grips with it because they're wedded to a certain methodology, and it's hard for them to break with that. So they have slowly in the industry said that online polling is growing in acceptance, but they will only give their imprimatur to those polling companies, notably at Stanford University, that buy computers for all their respondents. Well, I mean, that's nonsense. I think it's a tremendous insularity, and I think, like any other trade association, this is a clique of people that are working overtime to preserve themselves and do not understand that there can be folks with a newer and even better way of doing things. They've not been terribly kind to me, but they also haven't been terribly kind to Frank Luntz, who's a very good pollster, to Scott Rasmussen, very good pollster, to the fellow who's gotten the last two elections down to the percentile, TIPP, that polls for Investors Business Daily. These are the four of us that get these elections. Well, Luntz is not doing election polling per se anymore, but the three of us who get closer than anybody else, and we're not seen as part of that establishment.
Next question, I'm going to quote again. Being a fan of qualitative research, I'm interested in how we can do this better. Important to have the entire story more than just pick one.
Okay, I'm a huge fan of qualitative research. And in fact, three books that I've written have been based on polling, but I don't think would have been as effective as they became if I didn't have stories attached to who these people really are. They're not, we are not data points. I mean, data is interesting and it's useful and I love it, but you are not our 337, respondent 337. You're a whole person, and you're, we could have two 36-year-old women who are white and Roman Catholic and live in similar sized towns who are as different as night and day. And so there are limits to what simple demographics tell us. You know, what's a millennial? A millennial can be Ivanka Trump and LeBron James, you know, who are roughly the same age. We need to go beyond that and to flesh out their stories. So I love focus groups. I love one-on-one interviews. I love Brady Bunch focus groups. Talk about technology. I'll get six or seven of you on a screen, all in different parts of the world, parts of the country, talking to each other. That interaction is important. That tells me a story about, can you be persuaded by an argument or by a person? So, let me see the question. How can we do this better? Important to have the entire story than just pick one? Of course, it's more important to have the entire story. We try to tell it. You know, I'd encourage you, of course, my books you can get in the 25% bin at Walmart, I suppose, these days. But and if I sign it, it'll be worth 19 cents. I would suggest that you take a look at some of the articles that I write for Forbes or go to our website. Look at my son Jeremy's work, The Intelligencer, where he takes our polling and projects, you know, what's the future of work? What's the future of religion? What's the future of human rights? Really does it from a human perspective.
Thank you. Next question, will you offer financial incentives again to do when you're doing your polling?
Yeah, we do, but you know what, they're in the form of coupons, you know, so it's that's all that there is, and then an opportunity for a sweepstakes. I'm not a fan of that necessarily, but if it gets people to respond and the distribution of the response is good, then we're doing good polling, and I'm pleased with the distribution of the response, much more so than what we get on the telephone these days.
Great, next question. How would you suggest people view political polls and how should they react to them?
I think that political polls should be viewed as part of the mix, the holistic mix of an election. In other words, first of all, I think there's too much emphasis, there always has been, on the horse race. And not enough on the candidates, where they stand, what the differences are between them, and the negative advertising. But secondly, the polling is too one-dimensional. Here's who's ahead and by how much. And sometimes even reported as a forecast when it should be just capturing a moment in time. But I think that there has to be much more emphasis on what else the polls are telling us, not just one dimensional on so-and-so is for this issue and are certain people for this issue and certain are against this issue. Let's probe more deeply. But also I think that we need to see that polls are not a prediction or a forecast. Even 2 days before, what they are is capturing a moment in time. And it's probably not a bad idea to, in the same media story or just among consumers of politics, to take a look at two or three different polls. And instead of saying one's wrong and the other is right, look at them and say, well, what was it that they were asking? And how did people respond that would make those polls different? And then, of course, just dig a little deeper, just take 10 more seconds and click on the link of the poll and the story and ask, what was the sample? Was it skewed? Are there too many Democrats? Are there too few Republicans? Are there not enough young people? I hope that helps.
Thank you. Similar question. Polls used to be footnotes at the end of a political story. Now they seem to be the entire premise for stories. How can we get parties and media to put the emphasis on explaining the issues and attitudes towards those issues?
Boy, if the media doesn't get it by now, then they're going to put themselves out of business. And they almost are. I mean, look at your newspaper, look at your local news. I mean, people are still consuming and watching them, but they're not trusting and believing them. And so this leads to a broader question. First of all, the polls in 2016 were not bad at all. And I kind of resent hearing that about the failure of 2016. And in all honesty, because I had sold my company, I wasn't polling in 2016. So I'm being very gracious now to my competitors. But the polls captured the Hillary Clinton popular vote nationally. And if you looked at the battleground states, you saw over the last 10 days of the campaign, Hillary go from 10, 11, 9-point leads in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, New Hampshire, North Carolina. Each day, the trajectory was down so that by the polls that came out the day before the election, she was down to 1- and 2-point leads, ties, down in North Carolina by a couple of points. I mean, basically, the trajectory was there. And if the media had covered it honestly, what they would have reported was not Hillary still leads and therefore is going to win Pennsylvania. They would have noticed that the polls were telling a story. What is that story? Why is her lead dissipating? And how could it be that Donald Trump has a chance of winning? But that refers back to something that I said earlier, which is the media really hated Donald Trump, and he hated them, but they let it all play out on his turf, because a populist candidate like that thrives when the other side hates him, becomes Donald Trump victim, and he played that perfectly. So I was, you know, doing television in Washington, election day 2016. I was writing for Forbes live, and I was telling them, anybody who's telling you this is election day, that this election is sewn up, don't believe them. Something's going on here. There's a downward trajectory. By the time those early exit polls came out, it was clear this race could go either way in those battleground states. All of which goes back to the original question. Cover the election honestly and append the polls to the story where they deserve to be appended. But treat the polls more holistically. One poll is saying this, another is saying that. Don't cherry pick the one that you happen to agree with. Boy, my answers are long. Sorry.
No problem. Next question. When were the highest years of third party or independent polling activity that you recollect? And what can you tell us about those circumstances?
Okay, so since I've been a pollster, that's 84, because obviously you have George Wallace. But, you know, clearly Ross Perot, you know, in 1992, 19% of the popular vote. But for a while, before he self-imploded the first time, this guy was tied, even ahead by a point or two, going into the Democratic convention in July. It was a three-way race where each was, Clinton and George H.W. Bush were, you know, at a third. So clearly that one, and he did implode. I would have to say again in 1996, because then he got 8% of the vote. No electoral votes, but certainly enough to make a difference, you know, in both elections. From there, you know, the Ralph Nader election, you know, in 2000, it ultimately mattered, you know, because the election was so close. What does happen typically is support for those third parties goes down, especially in a closer election. People say, you know, I better take this seriously. And then you find that the third party gets a larger cluster of its support in runaway states where it doesn't, like New York, doesn't matter if you vote for a Libertarian or a Green candidate. Democrats just going to win the state hugely. States, when they get, you know, razor thin, you do see the support for the third party dissipate. But yeah, Ralph Nader, from there, you know, Gary Johnson was interesting in 2016, ultimately collected, you know, about 2% of the vote, but he was polling 4%, you know, going into the election.
I think we have time for one more question. So you spoke about the internet as a viable option for polling, especially with the lack of household landlines. What about populations who live in areas that are not well served by broadband or wireless internet?
Yeah, that's a good point. So we are at a point where there are some, you know, certainly some rural areas that are. I was just looking at census data. The most recent that we have is 2018. And internet penetration really is high across the country. There still are pockets, but I will But I will say this: even at the peak of the landline telephone, was 96% of households penetrated. So not only were there 4% without landlines, and there were no cell phones at that time, but a higher concentration in poor or rural areas. So it is an issue, but you can still draw a reasonable sample. Because realistically, you have to say to yourself, those are areas too with a, you know, a higher propensity of people who are not likely to vote and who are not likely to shop at whatever retail outlet you're polling.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I just want to thank you again, John, for coming to speak with us. So please join me in thanking John Zogby.
Thank you.